The Jewish Heritage Foundation presents The Epic of the Eternal People, an in-depth study of Jewish history based on original source material given by Rav Shmuel Irons, Rosh HaKollel, Dean of the Kollel Institute of Greater Detroit, one of the leading centers of Talmudic research and community education in North America.
This lecture, titled Bustanoi, The Story of the Jewish Prince and the Persian Princess, is dedicated to the honor and merit of Sora Bas Pesach, Miss Alexandra Leah Seidel. One of the most famous Arabic works of the Middle Ages is Aleph Leila wa Leila, 1001 Nights, better known as the Arabian Nights. The heroine Scheherazade's fantastic tales of Aladdin, Sinbad the Sailor, and Ali Baba and the 40 Thieves have long become part of Western literature and are well known to all of you here tonight. This Arabic tradition of embellishing history with myth had its Jewish counterpart in tonight's story, Bustanoi. Bustanoi, the hero of our story, was a real historical personage and the subject of heated rabbinical debate. The standard version of his story, as it was quoted in the 18th century work Seder HaDoros, makes great reading, which we're going to read together, and was the basis of Rabbi Marcus Lehman's famous novelette, Bustanoi. Unfortunately, as we shall see, it contains much myth intermixed with real history. The whole incident and the controversy that it sparked forms an intriguing chapter in our history. The life and legend of Bustanoi and his family is the topic of tonight's lecture. The following account tells the story of Bustanoi. This is how it begins in a small work, which was devoted, which was created in the Middle Ages, devoted to tell us the story of Bustanoi. And it was quoted by the Seder HaDoros, which was, a monumental work, which was a compilation of historical data compiled in the 18th century by the Rav of Minsk. As it begins, and I believe we should read this together because we're going to point out important points in this story, and we're going to contrast them with other stories and other accounts of these events. It begins of the accounting the story of Bustanoi, the benefits of Jewish people derived from him, and the reason why the House of David, the Reish Galusa, the exilarch, seals documents with a seal in the form of a fly. The seal had the form of a fly. And this is the preface to the story. This story is a long story. It's made up of several parts. And we're going to read together the first part. We're going to continue on. In the reign of the Persians, there arose a king who was mentally deficient. This story was written much after the Persian Empire was destroyed. And you'll notice, unlike other historical works, no king's name is mentioned and no date is mentioned. It is written in story form. He came up with the idea to destroy the royal seat of the House of David. And it seems this idea came about because he was mentally deficient. There's no reason, there's no why. Seems one day he woke up and decided, according to this narrative, to destroy the Jews. He hunted down all of the royal seed of David throughout his kingdom and had them killed. He imprisoned their relatives, in-laws, and all of their close friends and had them tortured. He also commanded the jailers to pour the soup of their abominations, it would seem, it's not clear, but it would seem referring to pagan sacrifices upon them, and to make them impure and sully them with their cooked carrion. In other words, even if they wouldn't, it's not clear if he forced them to eat, But they threw all kinds of food that they would normally not eat. So it was a form, basically, of torture. He decreed that the house of David's children should be mutilated and the stomachs of those pregnant with them should be cut open. Through the compassion of God upon the house of David, a daughter-in-law of the house of David was spared. She had been married to one of the young men of the house of David. He was killed during their 7 days of marital festivity after she had already become pregnant. So the beginning of this story creates the fact that the entire house of David has been killed by a deranged king who evidently suffered from some sort of paranoia, because there's absolutely no reason given why this he would have done this. And again, it was not carried out against Jews. It was just carried out specifically against the house of David. But we are left that there is one person left, and she, of the family, she is pregnant, carrying what seemed to be the last of the house of David. We are first going to go over the story, and then we are going to check this story through other historical sources. But it makes great reading in any case. And I think that's why the author of the book wrote this book, because the Seder HaDoros really is just quoting from this. The next part now is the dream. Again, the king had already killed out the entire house of David. He had left, unknowingly, one woman who had been married for a short period of time to one of the house of David. She was pregnant. She had escaped. All of the other relatives were imprisoned. This is the setting of the next part of our story. Now is the dream. The king had a dream. No, he didn't see the promised land. In it, he was standing in an orchard filled with beautiful fruit trees. In the dream, he was aware that the orchard did not belong to him. It was a dream, but he sensed it was somebody else's orchard. And he viewed himself in this dream as he began to throw the fruit off the trees in a fit of rage. After he totally destroyed the trees and the fruit of the orchard, he started searching for any remaining root that would eventually bear fruit in the future. Again, one could see the analogy here. After searching, he did find a single root that had a small shoot growing from it. As he lifted his axe to destroy it, he beheld an old man standing opposite him. The man was of ruddy complexion with beautiful eyes and a handsome appearance. The man scolded him with great anger and let out a loud and bitter scream. He then grabbed the axe out of his hand, of the king's hand, and planted it in the king's forehead. Blood poured out onto his face, as all in the dream, and his beard, and the king was close to death. Falling down with his face to the ground, he cried and pleaded with him, with the person of this elderly man, this ruddy complexion. "Please, my master, may my pleas find favor with you to stop you from destroying me. What did I do to you? What is my sin and transgression you've come to destroy me?" The old man replied, "Do you consider this a small matter that you've come to my orchard to destroy it?" And he started reasoning with him. "If you see a desirous fruit, why didn't you eat of it or put it in your vessel and carry it home with you? If you wanted to create your own orchard of fruit trees, why didn't you transplant some of them?" Like it was an act that he saw of just, it was purely destructive. "And it wasn't enough for you to uproot branches, leaves, flowers, plants, and fruit. You went ahead and searched out the orchard to destroy any remaining growing root. I felt pangs of sorrow for my orchard, which I had planted and watered and cultivated for many years. There's nothing left of the orchard save this one root. I said to myself, perhaps there's still hope. This will be my source of comfort. I will water it. I will cultivate it till it sprouts branches. Then we plant the entire orchard from its roots. You then lifted up your axe to destroy it so that nothing would be left of my orchard. And now you have the audacity to say that you consider yourself guiltless? Behold, this is an enormous sin. It would only be a partial punishment for your abominable sins to rid you from this earth and blot out your name from beneath the heavens. The king continued to cry before him and fell by his feet on the ground and pleaded with him. And now begins the repentance of the king. Please, my master, he said, I have acted foolishly. Now, since I have great regret, please may my life be deemed precious in your eyes and don't kill me. I truly pledge to properly water this shoot in a timely manner, to attend to its needs, and to guard it day and night until it flourishes like a majestic cedar tree. And remember, we're going to see this expression again of cedar tree. From its shoots will I replant the rose of this orchard until it will finally reach its former state. And as for what I have done, please forgive me, for it was in error. So we're now finished with his dream. The king arose from his sleep and found blood all over his bed. This is really an embellishment of the story. I mean, this really makes great reading. He couldn't fall back to sleep and was very anxious and disturbed until the morning. When he got up, he called all his wise men and astrologers. And again, if you'll notice, this is the parallel to the story in the book of Daniel. Of Nebuchadnezzar had a very disturbing dream, and he had no one who could explain the meaning of that dream. And told them of his anguish. They were quiet, for they did not know what to answer. One of his servants raised his voice and said, again a parallel to the story of Daniel, "My master, the king, don't you know that the wise men of the Jews and the royal seed were like kings in their exile? All of their material needs were constantly provided for by the Persian kings that preceded you, so that they, the Jews, may resolve all of the problems of the Persian kings and interpret their dreams. You have just laid out a plan to destroy them with great wrath." And again, he doesn't say that they should ask any Jew. They should ask specifically Jews that are related to the house of David. "They are imprisoned in jail, tortured and shackled. Now if you find it befitting in your eyes, search amongst the remnants of their wise men for an elder scholar with discernment, who after standing before you and listening to your account of the dream, be able to understand the meaning of your dream. Perhaps through one of them you will find the answer." His proposal found favor with the king, and he commanded his servants that one of the Jewish scholars be released, his clothing changed, and be brought to stand before him in order to provide an answer to this pressing question. For the answer to this problem, the messenger was going to tell this to these prisoners, and perhaps one of them would rise to the occasion. For the answer to this problem eluded his own scholars, and the Jews are renowned as amazing scholars that know all secrets. The servant of the king came to the prisoners, he came to the dungeon, and told them the words of the king. "One of the elders, who was the father-in-law of one of the young men of the royal house of David, who was killed in the days of the marriage celebration, said, 'I will stand in front of the king and tell him all that is in my heart.' His fellow prisoner said to him, 'Why do you have to rush into this matter? You don't know what questions he's going to test you with.' 'The king has dreamt a dream,' he replied, 'and I have seen the same dream, and I know the correct interpretation.' His colleagues recognized his wisdom and sincerity and said unto him, 'May the Lord your God help you and grant you grace before the king, so you'll not be put to shame.' The servant of the king said to him, 'Wash and anoint yourself with oil,'" and just clean yourself up. He said, "Clean yourself up. Here are clothes for you. Take them and change from your prison clothes, for it is the commandment of the king." The elder then swore they would not change before we'd have audience with the king. He wanted the king to see him in his disheveled state, to have a sense of what he had done, and perhaps the king would have some remorse. As he came before the king, the appearance of his mourning was evident in the dreadful smell of the spilled soup. They had been totally been abused, wafted through the air, and everyone saw that he was crying. The king said, "I have dreamt a dream, and there's no one here that can offer an interpretation. Do you know how to interpret dreams?" He replied, "The interpretation of dreams is in God's hands. Tell me your dream, or if you desire, I will tell it over to you." The king then said, "If you know, then you tell it." And again, there's this parallel to the story of Daniel, where the king had the dream. In that story, he had forgotten the dream, and Daniel actually told him the dream. He proceeded to tell him over the dream, including details that he had already forgotten. The king was amazed and exclaimed, "I swear that you haven't added or subtracted any detail. However, interpret it, for it is an amazing feat." He then began to interpret it while his eyes were shedding tears. "My master, the king," he said, "the orchard that you saw was the family of the house of David. The trees, big and small, were its sons, elders, young men, and infants. The tasty fruits that were pleasant to the sight were the scholars who understood every area of knowledge. They acted with kindness and justice. That which you got up in your dream in a fit of rage to destroy every tree and branch, together with its leaves, refers to your decree to kill them, to cut open the stomachs of those that are pregnant with them, and to crush their infants at the point of the sword, an act of murder and destruction. When you searched the orchard for a remaining root, in order to uproot it, you found one root remaining from among the people of the land. It is true, for there's one woman who has remained from the house of David who has recently become pregnant. You're seeing the root and lifting up your axe to destroy it refers to the fact that you were planning to search for this girl in order to destroy the royal seed. The old man who appeared to you and who scolded and screamed at you was David, king of Israel. And you notice in the dream he had a ruddy complexion. King David, David HaMelech, was ruddy and a red complexion. You're pleading with him to let you water the furrows of the orchard until the shoot grows into a majestic cedar." Again, remember the expression cedar refers to the fact that you will make a new pact from this day on to guard the pregnant woman together with all the relatives of the house of David. And the king replied, "I really know that your interpretation is true. Search and make an investigation to find the woman that is pregnant with the seed of David. I will act unto her with kindness. I'll place my beneficial attention on the woman and the seed that she produces, and I will fulfill the guarantee that I've made to raise the child and honor him as long as I live on this earth." As the elder heard these words, he couldn't hold himself back and raised his voice in tears. "My master, the king, it is true that I have drunk the bitter cup and have emptied its contents. I married off my daughter to one of the most outstanding young men of the house of David. In the middle of the marriage festivities, he made a decree to destroy all of the family of David, and he was caught up together with them. I was immediately imprisoned with all of my family's relatives and friends. My daughter has remained a forlorn widow for many months. I'm not sure if she's pregnant or not." And again, this seems to contradict the statement that he made before for this one woman. But maybe he wasn't sure. Maybe there was somebody else. This was the best candidate. He knew that's what the dream meant. And perhaps this was the best candidate to fulfill the dream. The king replied, "Go to your home and tell your daughter that I've released you and all of the friends that have been imprisoned with you. Behold, I have decreed not to torment you any longer, rather take special care of you." The king then removed the signet ring from his hand and gave it to him to affix an official document to guarantee all of these things. And note again the parallel of this expression to the story of Purim, where Ahasuerus gives the signet ring to Esther, to Mordechai. They released all of the prisoners, and the elder went back to his home. Through all of this, by the way, we know not the name of the king, nor do we know the name of the elder, and we don't know the date. We just know this general story. People, now we continue on to now finding the new and the cultivating and finding a new heir to the house of David. And again, the point that I want to make, it would seem from all of this that this Bustanoi was the only surviving heir to the throne. Had he died, the story would appear that there's absolutely no one on earth who is a descendant from the house of David. And this is a point I want you to keep that in mind as we look at the historic sources and to compare them to this story. People informed the elder that God had granted a pregnancy to his daughter. He rejoiced and gave thanks to God, and the entire Jewish people rejoiced together with him. The elder returned to the king and told him the news. The king rejoiced as well. He called unto one of his servants and commanded him to clear out a room in the court of the king for the young woman to use during her pregnancy and to see to it that she has all of her needs, including her bedding, and that should be brought to him. They prepared everything for her as the king commanded. It was all done with great dignity. She, her father, and her relatives were greatly honored. He hurried his servants to bring out for her her bed and all that she may desire. And again, notice we're going to see this expression coming up again. Through the summer and winter, nothing was lacking. It was all supplied with the expansive hand of the king. At the end of the term, she gave birth to a son. She called him Bustanoi, as a remembrance of the orchard that the king saw in his dream. The Persian name for an orchard is Bustan. So Bustanoi is he of the orchard, because he is a product, the fact that he was saved is a product of this dream of the orchard. There was rejoicing amongst the Jewish people. People far and wide received the good tidings that God had left a remnant of the house of David and remembered his compassion and kindness so as not to destroy his seed. They praised the Lord God. Do not forsake the face of your anointed one. Remember the kindness of David. Bustanoi grew and studied Torah, Mishnah, Talmud, Halacha, wisdom and understanding. At this point then, Bustanoi is not only his mother is spared, he grows under the watchful, in other words, at least comes to full term under the watchful eye of the king, and he continues on and grows to be a great scholar. Now we are going to that part of the story which was we mentioned in the preface to the story, that the Reshe Galusa, the exilarchs, when they sealed their documents, it had the picture of a fly on it, which is very, very unusual. Now it goes to explain how this came about. The king was told all about Bustanoi. And it was after he was born. He was raised within the Jewish community. He had nothing to do with the king. But he had heard about him, and he wanted to see him. He commanded his servants to bring Bustanoi before him. God granted Bustanoi a gracious appearance similar to the majestic appearance of grace that David possessed. As he stood before the king and his wise men were amazed at the young man. He stood in front of the king from the beginning of the day until nightfall. He didn't even move his head. And again, there's a parallel to this, again, in the book of Daniel, where the Jewish captives and the whole entourage of the king had to stand stiff attention throughout the whole day, without moving a muscle. A fly came and landed on his forehead. The forehead had the appearance of a ruddy slice of pomegranate. Evidently he wants to find why would the fly land on his forehead. It could be in a lot of other reasons, those who have experienced the problem. And the fly started biting him. He didn't drive the fly away, and the fly continued to bite until he started bleeding in front of the king. The king asked him, "What has happened to you?" He replied, "That which you see, my master, the king." He looked, and he saw the fly biting into his forehead. "Why don't you drive it away?" the king asked. He replied, "We have inherited this proper manner from our forefathers. From the time the royal crown was removed from us and we were exiled, we were required to stand in the palaces of the kings. We do not speak nor laugh, nor do we lift up our hands in their presence." His etiquette pleased the king. He realized that Bustanoi was a man of intelligence. He immediately issued a royal decree that Bustanoi ride the chariot of the vizier, again a parallel to the story of Yosef. be given gifts in great abundance, and the people shout before him as he rides in this chariot. This is Kocha Yeyosa, in other words, from the story of Purim. This honor is most befitting to the head of the Jewish exile. This was all done because the king realized Busunoi's intelligence and wisdom, even though we were really only told the fact as he stood in stiff attention. And from that, you know, we'd probably say, why don't you just, you know, we wouldn't see great intelligence over there. But evidently the king saw otherwise. The joy of the Jewish people was boundless, for God had saved a remnant of the house of David. Again, it's understood in this story, no one else remained except for Busunoi. Again, it's reiterated. And now we have, it begins something which is, I don't believe there's any other historical source we can compare this to, but on the surface seems very odd. But perhaps the author of this, at least in this instance, had a historical source upon which to draw. The king commanded him to appoint judges that would be under his, Busunoi's, jurisdiction. In other words, Busunoi was now in charge of the whole Persian judiciary, and to involve himself in all the needs of his government, the Persian king's government, and in addition now to direct the autonomous Jewish judiciary, and to direct the Rosh Yeshiva of Sur, Pumbedisa, Nardaw, that there be judges under his jurisdiction throughout the whole Jewish community. This arrangement lasted a long time until an Arab king arose who personally appointed judges for all the nations and had no further need for Jewish judges. Evidently, from this statement, it seems that actually the Busunoi appointed, you know, judge of judiciary, for they were from people that he knew. The position of Reish Galusa, however, did not cease. One would think, just reading these words, you know, the Arabs who conquer the Persian Empire were quite sharp. How long do you think it lasted from the time that they conquered the Persian Empire until they realized, you know what, we have to have our own judges? Especially that the law that they were now enforcing was a whole different system of law. It was an Arabic system of law. And you would think, therefore, that it must have been, you know, quite soon after the conquest, and as soon as they started creating an infrastructure and putting their men into office. And if this is historically correct, then Busunoi had this appointment many years before the Arab conquest. I mean, again, if this is historically correct. And we're going to come back to this again. When did Busunoi live? Again, this account has no dates. But there is an incident from which we can date Busunoi later in this story. The position of Reish Galus, however, did not cease. It is for this reason that the seal of the exilarchs, the Reish Galus, is in the form of a fly, as a reminder of the incident of the fly that was on Busunoi's forehead as he stood in front of the king. So the fly is basically saying that this is how he got the power and position that he had, was by virtue of this fly. It seems so. The other details of the story of Busunoi and how the king raised him by the other ministers is written in the Book of Recollections of the House of David. This is, we find a parallel to this throughout all of Sefer Melachim, the Book of Kings, when they bring the story of what happens to the kings of Judea in a brief form. It is said that the greater details are all contained in the Sefer Zichronos, in this Book of Recollections to the house of the Beis David, the house of David. He is assuming, the author here, that it kept on continuing on, which is not clear. We at least today have no record of the existence of such a work. And now we're going to another. So up until now, let's just summarize what we have. We have an insane king who kills out the whole house of David, save one woman who is pregnant. Because of a dream that the king has, she spares the life of the woman and the child. The child grows up. The king is interested in seeing him. He stands at attention in front of the king throughout the whole day. It doesn't bother the king that this poor person is just standing there the whole day. A fly comes, and this is, you know, evidently those Persian flies must be really vicious. The fly went, bored into the forehead of this of Bustanoi. The blood was dripping. The king was amazed, and he said, "It's because of our discipline, the respect for the king." The king was so taken that he gave him this entire position. As he restored him to the position, gave him, put him in charge of the Persian judiciary. And it was because of him and because of the fly that the house of David, the exilarch, the position of exilarch was restored. The Persians, though, eventually were defeated by the Arabs. This is the subject of a previous lecture. Here in paragraph E we have, and this is again from the same story, we saw fit to mention a small incident reflecting his greatness. Once the Arab king Ali ibn Abu Talib, together with many of his ministers, came to the city in which Bustanoi resided. By the way, Ali, which is we're going to in detail the last lecture of this series, we're going into detail about Ali and the Shiites and the whole early Muslim history. Ali became the caliph, the head of Islam, in the year 656. He was assassinated some 5 years later. It's not clear when in the reign it occurred, but at least we have some idea, according to this story, about, we're going to see the age of Bustanoi. He came, together with his ministers, came to the city which Bustanoi resided, and this is in parentheses in the original work, had a population of 80,000 Jews. Bustanoi came out to greet him with a Sefer Torah and other scrolls of scripture, together with the holy names of God, and it's not clear what this is or why it was necessary to bring out, that he held in his possession. Together with a tremendous throng of people from the Jewish community went out to greet the Arab king. The king was overjoyed and asked Bustanoi to bless him and pray for him. Ali gave Bustanoi beautiful clothing from the spoils of war that he had amassed. Ali, now we go to the story, which is the second part of the Persian princess. Ali asked him, this is all the time when he came out with the whole Jewish community to greet Ali, if he had any sons. He replied that he was not yet married, for he had not found a suitable girl. Is that problem with Shidduchim even then, it seems. Yeah. The king was astounded that Bustanoi was not yet married, for he was already 35. And it is strange. Everybody take heart, you know. As a result, Ali gave him Dara, a beautiful young virgin, and the daughter of the vanquished Persian king, to be his wife. Again, the name of the Persian king is not mentioned. Bustanoi at first did not want her. Ali forced upon him an oath and forced him to take her. Ali said to him, "She is befitting a person of your stature. Behold, your forefather David, Dovid HaMelech, took beautiful concubines and lived with them without either a marriage ceremony or a contract." Bustanoi replied that one is allowed to take a non-Jewish woman without a formal marriage, only at times of war. And this is not exactly true either, we're going to see. In peace times, however, one is only allowed to marry with a marriage contract ceremony, and immersion in a mikvah is part of the conversion to Judaism. Actually, there's a question about at what time a person is allowed in time of war, you know, to take, this is Yafas Toar, and that's to take a woman in a time of war, but he's only allowed to have relations with her once, and he cannot have any other relations with her until she converts and goes to the mikveh. So it's it's really not, even the thing of taking non-Jewish women is only, there's an opinion that he can't take her at all, he could just set her aside and eventually have her convert. But the opinion that has that there's a relations are allowed, it's only one time during the time of the capture. And after that, she has to go through a whole ceremony. She's in the house, and she cries, as described in the Torah, beginning of Parshas Ki Tse. The king replied, "You have the power to do with her as you please." We have this bold Bustanoi, because it's a very important part of this story. Bustanoi took her for a wife after he had immersed her in a mikveh for conversion, after making for her a formal marital contract and a marriage ceremony. She found favor in his eyes, and she gave birth to sons. After his death, the sons of his other wife, who became princes, set to the sons of Dara. And if this, following this story, it would seem at that point he wasn't married. So there must be that these must be children that came afterwards and were younger than the children of Dara. When we just follow the story. "You have no portion in the inheritance of our father, for you are the sons of a slave woman. There was a great quarrel, and the matter came to the attention of the Jewish authorities. They all ruled that they not be denied a portion of their father's inheritance, nor is their communal status in any way to be diminished. Although their mother did not have a marriage contract in her possession, there was no formal proof of the conversion of marriage, they made the ruling on the basis of the legal principle, and that which we're going to see, that a person would not have extra conjugal relations with a woman that he could legally make his wife. A principle that applies even to a commoner, most certainly to a prince and scholar of Bustanoi's stature. All of this is written in the book of the House of David." So ends this story, as is quoted in Sefer HaDoros. What would seem a little odd, according to this version of the story, the other children of Bustanoi, who put this claim that the other ones, that the ones of the Persian princess are truly slaves and not truly recognized fully as Jews, would have to have probably been young adults at least, I mean, to have laid a claim like this. Where did their other older brothers go? I mean, if they were older, I mean, presumably they would have also, if they were truly Jewish, they would have gotten a Jewish education. They would have gone to cheder, to yeshiva. They would have been treated, they would daven in a minyan. And if not, it would be indicative that they would be treated as slaves. I mean, the story as it's written has a real problem to it. As we're going to see other versions, there were just pitzalach then. They were just little kids. And in that case, there was really nothing evident of their Jewish status because really, at that age, they were just beginning to go to nursery or kindergarten. According to this version, when he met the Arab king, the Arab king asked him, "Are you married?" He was 35. He said, "No." "Well, I have a beautiful girl for you. She's talented, she has alamailas. This is a wonderful, wonderful girl. One little problem, but we can take care of that too." Right? You know, it's like the Jewish, you know, about the story about the shadchan, that he's trying to read a shidduch, and he's just trying to convince the young man about seeing this young girl. And he starts, "I think, this, you should look into this girl." He says, "I know her. You know, she's blind in one eye. She has wonderful, you can do anything around the house. She won't even see, a complete privacy." He says, "But she's deaf. She's hard of hearing." "It's great." He says, "She doesn't have to listen to your conversations. Look at the mileage." He says, "See, hinked of a fuss, she's lame, she has a problem walking. Great, if you have an argument, she can't chase after you." He says, "But she has a hunchback." So the shah says, "No." He says, "Have you ever found a girl without one chasorin, like without any fault?" "That's a fault, it's a chasorin, one little thing." He says, "Also, there's a wonderful girl, just one little thing." So it seems that this was the first woman he married. Then it would seem to be, if we follow this story, then the other Jewish woman that he would have married subsequently, they would have children. The children should have been younger than this. So, and yet these younger children are now putting a claim in court. Evidently they're of enough sound mind to, you know, to present a case in court. It isn't that the family is presenting the case or someone else is presenting the case. How it's written in this story is the kids themselves are presenting the case. Well, were the children raised as Jews or not? That's something you could see. No, but you would have known the children. Well, the 5-year-old kids aren't coached, you know, and they can't put claims. When you want to go put a claim in a court, you have to be at least a bar mitzvah. Oh, if they were all older, and we see that's clear, if they were raised by Bustanoi to go to yeshiva, then they were yeshiva bachrim. They davened with a minyan, and they were yeshiva bachrim, put on tefillin. They didn't act like slaves. It was evident then that they were not slaves, because Bustanoi himself gave them, treated them with the status of his own children. You know, when they had the Seder, they were the first ones to make Kiddush, you know? He treated them like his own children. It's a little strange. Yes. After Bustanoi's death, then the Jewish heirs, the definitely Jewish heirs, put in this claim. So the way this is written, it seems very strange. You have to realize, they may have put in the claim when they were 13. By the time they were 87, it finally came in front of the magistrate. But as reading, whatever you're going to say as a critique of the story, it makes a very good story. It's very interesting that there are very strong parallels, and this is pointed out by historians, Rav Isaac Halevi and others, to another story which does have dates, which does have people and has names, which would seem to be, on the hand, much more reliable, and it is really a work which is relied upon widely by historians, and it was written in the time of the Gaonim. This is called Seder Olam Zuta, and we quoted from this in the last lecture of last year. These are events that occurred in the beginning of the 6th century. Bustanoi lived in the 7th century. Rav Kahana, the Reish Galusa, died. This is taken from the Seder Olam Zuta. Rav Huna Mar, his brother, subsequently inherited his position. When he died, Rav Huna Bar Rav Kahana, his nephew, or this is the thing, inherited the position. Through him, the house of David was destroyed. Again, another incident of how the house of David was destroyed. The following is an account of the events. The wife of Rav Huna, Reish Galusa, was the daughter of Rav Chanina, who was the Reish Masifta. Rav Chanina was a man of vast scholarship and saintliness, the judge of the Reish Galusa. Now it tells a story. The Reish Galusa and his had a court. There's a court of law. And the judge, I guess the chief judge of the Reish Galusa, went and paid a visit to the city of Rav Chanina. The Reish Masifta of Chanina was the head of a yeshiva and desired to deliver lectures to the student body of that city. The Reish Masifta did not let him. The judge subsequently went back to the Reish Galusa and told him what had occurred. The Reish Galusa issued orders and sent for the Reish Masifta and commanded that he be put into a ditch or dungeon of the city for the entire night. Now, as he wanted to, evidently this Reish Galusa was a person who had a terrible temper and did not show respect neither to Rav Chanina as his father-in-law, nor to Rav Chanina as being a tremendous scholar. He was the head of the Masifta. He was the Rosh Yeshiva. The next day he was brought before him after a night in prison, and the Reish Galusa issued an order that they pull out all the hair of his beard and they not be given any lodging in the city, as he was tortured. Thereupon the Reish Masifta went and sat down in the great synagogue and wept. Death immediately befell the house of the Resh Galusa, and they all died in one night. But at least in this story, we find a reason as to why this tragedy occurred. In the other story, it seems simply to be the capricious act of an insane king. And it's a little strange that afterwards the king doesn't seem to be so insane after all. You know, the first story of the Persian king, I mean, he seems to be, at least afterwards, quite rational. At least in this story, at least we find a reason why this occurred, but it does not tell us how it occurred. It seemed to be some sort of a plague. Marzutta remained of the house of the entire house of David in the womb of his mother. Again, you notice the parallel here. The house of David is totally killed. The father of the girl is a great scholar, as we had in the first story, but at least now we have a name. That night Rav Chanina dreamt that he had entered an orchard full of cedars holding an axe. He cut down all of the cedars one after the other. There was only left one young cedar. Remember the expression, one young cedar, we had in the first story, that had just sprouted from the ground. Chanina lifted up the axe to cut down this young cedar. An old man stood before him and screamed, "I am David, king of Israel. What right do you have to cut them down?" As he was speaking to him, he hit him on the head with a hammer, very similar. Chanina woke up from his dream in the morning and became aware of its meaning. Again, the same idea of a dream of a large group of trees that are all cut down except one little cedar. He inquires, "Is there anyone left of the family of Resh Galusa?" They told him, again, the inquiry, again, the same parallel to the story, told him that his daughter, the wife of the Resh Galusa, was the only survivor and that she was pregnant, and zealously guarded his daughter and slept by the entrance of her house, again, through the summer and winter. Remember, again, the parallel of summer and winter in the first story. When he was born, he took him unto him and taught him scripture, eventually made him into a great man. Again, the parallel that he raised him to be a great scholar. This is an event that occurred 100 years before the story of Bustanoi, the first story we read. And in this story as well, there's a derivation of the use of a fly in the seal of the king. When Marzutra was 15 years of age, he, together with the Resh Masifta, Rav Chanina's grandfather, went to the king and took back the position of leadership from Rav Pachta. Rav Pachta, as we're going to see, had been a son-in-law of the king, of the Resh Galusa, of the exilarch. In the absence of anyone else, he took the position, and it seemed he wanted to usurp the position, even though he himself was not of the house of David. A fly flew up the nose of Rav Pachta, which caused him to become ill and eventually die. This was the punishment for usurping the throne of the house of David. Because of this incident, a figure of a fly is engraved on the seal of the Resh Galusa. Marzut became Resh Galusa for 20 years, and Mar Rav Chanina and Rav Sam Rav Yitzchak were his resident scholars. From this story, again, the parallels, it's difficult to say the same story happened twice. This is the first story. This is the original story. And historians seem to assume the Seder Olam Zuta, which is a historical document which lists names of generations of the Resh Galusa, generation after generation, who their scholars were, was the original story. And it seems the story that we originally read was really a new story that took the major elements and redid it in a way that probably would sell better. You know, it's like the story of the little child who came back from Sunday school. And he spoke to his parents, and his parents says, "You know, what did they teach you today in Sunday school?" "Well, they taught us how the Israelites crossed the Red Sea." says, really? He says, what happened? Well, you know, the Egyptians were in hot pursuit of the Israelites, and they came to the Red Sea, and there was no way for them to cross. So the Israelite Corps of Engineers quickly put up pontoon bridges. And they ran across the bridge, and the Egyptians were still in hot pursuit. And while after the last Israelite put his foot, you know, off the pontoon bridge, the Egyptians were right behind him. The Israelite Air Force came, strafed the pontoon bridge, and all the Egyptians died. And the parent looked at the child and says, is that what they taught you in Sunday school? Well, not exactly, but you'd never believe the version they taught me there. It seems that the original source of the story we first read is taken from this story. What's interesting is the parallel of the seal. So here, it's in a sense the fly being on the seal is not a mere fluke, or to attribute this fly and the so, but really it's a lesson to others, don't mess. In other words, don't start up with us. You see this fly? That happened to the last one who started up. That's right. This Marzutra had a very colorful life. As we explained, again, this is the subject of the last lecture of the last year. He led a revolt against the Persian government, which was eventually suppressed. He was killed, his father-in-law was killed, and the whole house of David had to go into hiding. And here we have on page 11, the day, again this is also from the Seder Olam Zutra, the day that Marzutra, the Reish Galusa, was killed. May the memory of our prince be for a blessing. A son was born unto him. They called him Marzutra on the name of his father. The house of David fled for 30 years. Mar Achunoi wasn't able to reveal his face. And Mar Giza, the brother of the father of the house of Mar Barav Niloi, went and sat in Nahar Tsova. I guess these were related to the house. They were evidently Rosh Yeshivas. Marzutra, the son of Marzutra, Reish Galusa, went up to the land of Israel, and they elevated him to a position of Reish Pirka. He became a Rosh Yeshiva. This is the story of the dream. After the revolt, he was killed, and he had a son, and there was a period of time, there was for 30 years period of time, after that the position really became null and void. And there was a king that really tried to uproot the house of David. I mean, there is a historical parallel to the beginning of this story. But he was not successful. And the Jews were in hiding, those of the house. There were those who were left. And eventually an heir, a potential heir to the throne, decided to leave Persia, Babylon entirely, and went to Eretz Yisrael, went to Israel, and became a head of a yeshiva. But again, we have this part of the story actually has historical roots. The only difference being, of course, that there now is a reason why they would try to uproot the house of David, because they would look at the house of David as a political threat, because Marzutra, the father, actually led a revolt against the Persians. The name Bustanoi is an unusual name, and it would seem to lend itself, the idea of Bustanoi, to the idea of this orchard. And perhaps that's why the author of this story, not knowing the general outline of the story, thought that this Bustanoi, who eventually married the Persian princess, must have been the one who was the subject of the dream. I mean, there is a certain logic to this. However, the name Bustanoi we find as a contemporary of the Bustanoi of our story, of the first story. There was a Rav Bustanoi who became the Gaon of Pumpadisa, became a Rosh Yeshiva, head of a yeshiva, in the year 650. That's before Ali came to Babylon. This is evidently people, as Rav Isaac Halevi points out, those who became Rosh Yeshiva were very old. That's where their reigns were very short. This Rav Bustanoi must have been a man in his 70s. Born before Bustanoi, who was only 35, remember, when he met Ali at least 6 years afterwards. Which begs the question, how did he get the name Bustanoi? There is another document that came from the period of the Gaonim. This is a manuscript. I think it comes from the Cairo Geniza, which is of the genealogies of the Tanoim Vamaroyim. And it writes, I found in the record of the Gaonim, the one who's writing this found in the record, because we know from Roshir Gaon, the Gaonim kept historical records. Why did Rav Hanan, the Rosh Yeshiva do? Again, we find now another source besides the Seder Olam Zuta. It's always important, really, to have two sources. He went and placed bedding by the outside entrance to the house of his daughter. All the members of the yeshiva were there throughout all the months that the wife of the Reish Galusa was pregnant until she gave birth. There's a Gemara in Erevin and Chovov that says that there may be a practice, which the Talmud frowns on, to put scholars in front of a house that the Malach HaMoves, the angel, should not enter the house. And it seems based on that he put a yeshiva, in other words, they were always learning there as a protection, just like a mezuzah is maybe a protection, the yeshiva was a protection for the fetus as it's growing until birth. So again, we have another story. It was a male child, and she named him Zutra and Bustanoi. This is because he was the only remainder of that house and orchard in Persian is Bustan. So he's Rav Hanina, the Rosh Yeshiva. It seems to be the same Rav Hanina of the previous story. And this first one, he was called Bustanoi, the one of the Seder Olam Zuta, the one of the 6th century, not the 7th century. And it would seem that the Bustanoi of the beginning story was named after him, and that's why we find a Gaon who's older than the Bustanoi of the 7th century, also with the same name, as a tribute to this original Bustanoi. So the Bustanoi name really does not indicative of the original story in the dream, but actually comes from this later dream. And he was called Marzutra, but he was also called Bustanoi, and that was the name that the later Bustanoi received, and he was probably a grandson of the first Bustanoi, or great-grandson. So now we find the key to the name Bustanoi. There was an incident in that first story of Bustanoi coming out to greet the king, this Ali. It's funny, we have a parallel to that story, which is recorded by Rav Shrira Gaon, and it was not Bustanoi who came out to greet him, but it was one of the Gaonim, one of the great Rosh Yeshivas. Marav Yitzchak Gaon was the Rosh Yeshiva in Perush Shavur, which is not far from Nahar Dor, which is in the north part of the Jewish section by the Euphrates in Iraq, at the time that Ali ibn Abu Talib conquered the area. Mar Yitzchak went out to greet him, all accepted him graciously. There were 90,000 Jews in Perush Shabur, and Ali greeted all of them graciously. So again, we find another parallel to this story, but it was not Bustanoi, it was one of the Gaonim, Mar Rav Yitzchak Gaon. However, the story of the Persian princess is true. Perhaps the names have been changed to protect the innocent, but the story is true. The question is, as we're going to see the historical problems is, who was the father of this Persian princess? And who was the Arab king that gave her over in marriage to Bustanoi? We find all the other sources, besides the first story that we have, the one who gave Bustanoi in marriage was not Ali, who was the fourth caliph, but rather Umar, who was the second caliph. Umar was the conqueror of Iraq. By the time Ali came, Iraq had been firmly conquered. Ali had other problems. He had a revolt on his hands, as we're going to explain in the last lecture of this series. But he was not the conqueror of the Persians. They had already been conquered. In the days of Umar ibn al-Khattab, the king of the Arabs, the kingdom of Persia was destroyed. This is also taken from the Sefer HaKabbalah of the Ravid. The Ravid was an 11th, 12th century scholar in Spain who wrote a work of history describing the Kabbalah, the transmission of Torah from the beginning till his time. And in it he tells this story. The wife and daughter of Yezdegerd, king of Persia, were killed or led off in captivity. The Arab king gave the daughter of Yezdegerd to Rab Bustanoi, the Resh Galusa. He converted her and she became his wife. So at least we have the Arab name. It is not Ali, it's Umar. However, there is a question, who was the Persian king? At the time of the conquest of Iraq, Ctesiphon was the Iraqi capital, was really the capital, was situated in Iraq, and then the entire Persian Empire. It was the seat of government, and Yezdegerd was forced to flee when the Arab force of Umar came. The problem is, we know from historical sources, Yezdegerd had plenty of warning time and took his entire family and entourage with him as he fled from the Arabs, which makes the problem of taking his daughter historically a little difficult. There is another version here. And this is taken, this was one of the response of the Gaonim that was found in the Cairo Geniza. After the conquest of Ctesiphon, the conquering Arab army sent her Izdadoar, which is similar to the name Dara that was mentioned before as the name of the princess. Her mother Biran and her sister from the house of Khosru, the king of Persia, to Umar, the Arab king. We find now a different king, not Yezdegerd, but Khosru. If you'll take a look on the back page, we have a timeline. If you see the year 632, that happened to be the year of the death of Muhammad, was also the year of the death of Khosru II. There was a fight for power after his death. 2 years later, another person rose to power, not part of Khosru's line. I mean, not a direct lineage, because there were many kings in between. This was Yezdegerd, and 3 years subsequently, he was conquered. I mean, the capital was conquered by Umar. He fled to Persia, and it was only 15 years later that he himself was conquered, and the entire Persian Empire was conquered by the Arabs. Now, Yezdegerd fled from Ctesiphon. Khosru, though, who was a king who was really not part of the line, it's quite possible that his daughter, his wife, were still remained there because he wouldn't have taken steps to save them. Yes, the guard would only take steps to save his own family, which makes sense why they were still there, whereas Yezdegerd and his family had fled. So Chosru actually had died before, but these were his family that were still living there. He, Umar, took one of the sisters for himself and sent the other sister to Bustanoi. It was really, in this story, he was not asked, he sent it to her as a gift. Even though it was sent as a gift, he did not have conjugal relations with her until he had sent 52,000 zuz to Umar. Like he paid for her. While she was in his house, she gave birth for him to 3 sons, and these are all Persian names. He treated them as one would treat his own children, did not treat them as slaves. When he died, Chizdoy and the other older brothers, you know, in this story now, you read this version, the Jewish brothers were older brothers. He is already married, had older kids. Placed the sons of Izdador in slave quarters and began to treat them as common slaves. They claimed that Izdador was the daughter of a pagan king and never made a commitment to become a Jew. Afterwards, some of the Rabbonim argued that they should be considered valid Jews. There was a whole debate because she didn't have a ksuba. And there was no records of her being converted. It's a very murky kind of a situation. Their reasoning was based on the fact, just as the original story had it, that Bustanoi was a prince. If he had freed his daughter and immersed herself for the purpose of becoming a free Jewish woman, in the presence of witnesses or based in, he would have committed an avoidable immoral act. In addition to the rabbinic argument, the sons of Izdador used governmental pressure. The brothers of their mother were highly placed military leaders. In other words, the relatives, when the Arabs conquered, they assumed the Arabic faith, became part of their army, and were people of great influence. So here we had, there was rabbinic opinion, evidently, even though there seems to be an argument in rabbinic opinion, but there was governmental pressure. Sometime after this discussion, the grandson of the Siariar, one of the 3 sons, married the daughter of Rav Chaninoi, another, seems to be a common name, and the matter was finally put to rest. Subsequently, Zakai, Bar Mar Hachinoi, Bar Siariar, in other words, a grandson of Siariar, a great-grandson of Bustanoi, but through the line of the Persian princess, became Resh Galusa. And they considered him truly that he's not a son of a slave woman. This ruling, however, only was applied to the children of the prince, because it was unthinkable the prince would be in violation of Jewish law. It seems from this tshuva, had it been someone else, they would have not have dealt with it in the same way. Because really, she did not have a ksuba. She did not, there were no witnesses saying, we were at the chasana. It was only assumed, it must have happened, because how could Bustanoi, who was one of the gedolim, one of the great people, do otherwise? This is one version of the story. And it would seem to be, at least, a very reliable version, since it comes from the Gaonim. But there was no record. In terms of the question that I asked, you know, if they were raised and they were older and they went to yeshiva, and they, you know, that itself would be evident that they were not slaves. The next tshuva we have, again, this is from the Cairo Geniza. This was published by Solomon Schechter. Because we spoke about this before. This is really, he was a reader in Jewish and rabbinic literature in Cambridge. But he came across the Cairo Geniza, and what was not taken beforehand and put in other libraries, he took en masse and brought it to Cambridge. And he started publishing some of what was, a lot of them are just bits into fragments. It was a storage house of old documents. But he went, so this is one of the, the works that he published. But they were young children here. It wasn't, again, the problem is evident they were young when it occurred, so it was not really evident. How the in the first response, he treated them like children, and as he was nice to them. He didn't enslave them. But yet, the other things that were evident, if we know the halacha, if a master puts on tefillin on a slave, or makes sure he goes to studies in a regular yeshiva, it's evident that he's a free man. Otherwise, he wouldn't, the master would not have acted to the slave as a regular Jew. They were still young. All these simonim were not evident, those signs that they were Jewish kids and they acted in full response as a member of the Jewish community. They were still young. They were allowed, though, and it's interesting, the one who made the final, according to this tshuva, the final decision was Mar Rav Shmuel Gaon. If you, on the bottom, paragraph D, Mar Shmuel Gaon was the Gaon of Sura. He was a Gaon for a period of 18 years. He was appointed, he was not originally from Sura, he was originally from Pumpadisa, and he was appointed by Shloima Bar Chizdoi. Remember, Chizdoi, we had before, was the eldest son of Bustanoi from a Jewish mother, who had led the pressure that these children should be considered slaves. And yet it was Mar Rav Shmuel Gaon, who was an appointee, who really did not care and wanted truth should be, you know, should be said no matter what the cost. And he went ahead and pronounced them to be truly Jews. As we're going to see, the last one that we know of the line of Chizdoi, was the subject of a previous lecture. This Chizdoi had a son, Shlomo. When he died, he did not have heirs that would take the position. He had a brother, David, who had two sons. One of them was Anan, who was later the founder of the Karaite heresy, which was a discussion, was the topic of a previous lecture. He had a son, Hanina, who became the Reish Galusa. This was sometime in the year 762, 761, in those years. It was during this time that he was still pressuring this Anan to be Reish Galusa, till finally he was put into prison and then created a schism. So we have the year 760. At least in that year we know that there was a descendant from Chizdoi, from a Jewish mother of Bustanoi. We find in the next document, the next tshuva, though, from what we've seen up until now, it's clearly he was pronounced to be Jewish, the kids, because the father would have never have had consorted with her without the proper measures of the conversion and freedom. We do have a different version of this story, a version which is not so complimentary. It says, you know, it's the scholars of yeshiva debated the issue. There are those who said as long as she was not given her freedom, she was still a slave woman. Again, there was no documentation. Therefore, the children were considered slaves. Rav Chaninoi, evidently he's the first one who made the decision. The judge of the gate of blessed memory wrote a document granting freedom to the slave girl and her child. Notice he forced, and exactly how he did this, maybe through the power of the courts, he made the other brothers free her, the heirs free this woman. So in any case, even if she had not been freed before, she would be freed now. It's not clear exactly how legally he had this done, but he had this done. And then the argument continued. Well, but did Rav Chaninoi have to do this at all? Maybe he didn't have to do this. Because after all, again, the argument that was stated before, Bustanoi would have Adam Godel, a great man, would have never had relations with her had he not freed her. But the court itself was not that convinced of that argument. But they said, even though it's not true, is in the bottom of the page, he's still a freed man and therefore permitted to marry in the community. He was considered, though, to be a son of Bustanoi. Because even though the court ruling here was not 100% sure, they just said, well, maybe yeah, maybe no, but in any case, he's a freed man. They considered, even though that was not the original legal opinion, he came to be considered to be a true son of Bustanoi. But says there were those who felt, well, he may be Jewish, but if he's Jewish, and that the kids, though, were born before the mother converted, even though subsequently they were converted, they were not truly considered Bustanoi's children, and they would not be considered as part of the house of David, and therefore they would not be entitled to be an exilarch. They couldn't be a Reish Galusa if they truly were not of his seed. And that was the question here. And now we have from this other document that even though we had the first document seem to clearly point out that it was universally accepted, but yet we find in this document there were other great authorities that disputed this. It ends off, they ask this question to Marav Paltoi and Marav Natrunoi, the Gonim blessed memory of Pumbedisan Sura. This is at the end of the 9th century. They were the Gonim, you know, in the late 800s, many years afterwards. They felt that his status should be considered as that of a freed man. These Gaonim felt that they truly were not of the house of David. It's in historically, and this is the last lecture of our series, during their lifetime, there was another argument with the Reish Galusa that there was a feeling that he had abused his position. This Reish Galusa was a descendant of the Persian princess. They had deprived him of this office. And there were 5 years, there was a period of time there was no Reish Galusa at all. And it's quite possible that they, part of their opinion was based that they weren't exactly 100% sure that he was truly entitled to the position. Up until now, we've discussed that the heirs of the house of Bustanoi were from the Jewish wife, the definite Jewish wife, and were definitely heirs. When did the transition occur that now the children of Bustanoi become the heirs? And this is a fascinating story which is recorded in the letter of Rav Shmiragon. Discussing one of the Gaonim of Pumbedisa, he said he removed, this is on page 15, paragraph F, Natrunoi Bar Chavivoi from office after Natrunoi had fought with Zakai Bar Marav Achinoi, the exilarch, already been in the position of exilarch for many years. It seems the consensus is this Rav Natrunoi was a descendant of the and this is the year 770. Don't make any connections here. Says, remember, we had in the time of Rav Yehudoi going, and this we had in page 14, at least in the year 761 or 7, thereabouts, there still was an heir from the Jewish mother. Because Shlomo Bar Chisdoi, remember Chisdoi was the son from the Jewish mother, he had one son, Shlomo, who died without heirs. He had a brother, David, the son of Chisdoi, who left two sons. One was Anan, who created the Kerarites, it's schism. The other was Chaninoi, who became Reish Galusa. It seems by the year 770 already, there had already been a controversy as who's the next heir. Evidently, he did not last in office that long. This Chaninoi, Chanina. And it seems at that point, the one who filled the position was Zakai, who came from the Persian princess. This Rav Natrunoi, who was in the sideline, evidently felt that he had no right to this, based on the fact he felt that she was the slave woman, they're not truly from the house of David, even if he's really truly a Jew, but he is not truly of the house of David. And he And he argued that he should have the position and try to remove the Zakai. And there was a whole argument. This Marav Malka, to this Reish Galusa, decided in favor of Zakai, and Natrunoi was exiled. And this is the point in the year 770 that the sons of Bustanoi, the heirs of Bustanoi from the Persian princess, became the Reish Galusa. And they remained all the Reish Galusa until when the office being totally abolished, which we find remnants of that office into the 1200s. This is all came from the Persian princess. This Rav Natrunoi, by the way, was himself a tremendous Talmud Chacham. He was a student of Rav Yehudoi Goin, the one that is mentioned on page 14, and there is a tradition that he was exiled. He went to Spain, and those in Spain they did not have a full copy of the Talmud, and by memory he wrote down the entire Talmud, this Rav Natrunoi. So he was a person of tremendous prestige. One would say he'd be the most likely one to receive this position, and yet he was ousted in favor of Zakai. It's an amazing story. But there's a cloud, evidently we see from the tshuva, which we call on the top of page 15, that still remained over the house of Bustanoi. There were those, of course, and this is Mar Shmuel, and all those Gaonim that felt that he truly was, there was a true conversion here. And the children were really truly sons of Bustanoi, and that was the basis of their ruling, and that's why they were exilarchs. But there were yet others who had their reservations, and perhaps this for this reason Roshiragon makes the point. He says that Roshiragon himself says that he is from the house of David. Our forefathers were of the house of the exilarch, however they forsook the brutal and arrogant ways of the exilarchs, perhaps referring to the story that preceded Mar Zutra of the father-in-law, the Reish Galusa, who tore out the hairs of the beard of the father-in-law, the brutal ways, and went up to become rabbis of the Masifta in order to pursue a life of humility and self-effacement. By the way, they were evidently from the house, and we said there were other heirs, and even if everyone had been killed out from the Reish Galusa, there still would have been heirs of the house of David, which we pointed out evidently that all these stories are really hyperbole, because there were other heirs still in existence. We are not from Bustanoi. Made that point. Rather, before the time Bustanoi, elders went up to become rabbis of the Masifta. He evidently wanted to make the point there should be no cloud hanging over that he is truly descendant of the house of David. Again, there was no question of the Jewishness of the children of Bustanoi, simply because in any case they were given a document that freed them. And in any case, even if they weren't Jews, since they married Jewish women, the children would be Jews. So there's no question of the Jewishness of the question is, but are they truly descendants of the house of David? And this was, as we leave this, the situation that remained with the exilarchs until the end. As we will see in further lectures, those exilarchs who did come from the Persian princess caused an awful lot of problems. They were involved in all kinds of argumentation. Rav Sadia Gaon had a terrible dispute with David ben Zakkai, from a descendant of the Zakkai. And this really sets the stage for much of the subsequent history. In review, again, we started off with a fantastic story, a great bedtime story for your children. After analysis, though, it was found to be wanting Bustanoy was a historical person. It seems though he got his name. He was not the original Bustanoy. He was a grandson of the original Bustanoy, who was a product of such a fascinating story with a dream and the House of David being filled out. It seems also that the Arab king who sent him the wife was not Ali. The story with Ali was confused again with one of the Gaonim, but he was sent a Persian princess, and unlike the story, it is quite unclear as to the status of that Persian princess. And it would seem as that even though the final, the actual ruling was that they actually, the Persian princess had converted, there was still a cloud over the whole incident. Okay. Says I now, so are there any questions? Yeah, it's Babylon was part of the Persian Empire. Right. So when they say Persia, because it was part of the greater empire. Even though it's truly not Persian in culture, it's like Puerto Rico is part of, you know, it's part of the greater United States or Hawaii. This is this family. Again, we find from a shrew ago, and there was a section that was of the House of David that were not involved in politics. I mean, look at the press that he's getting. I mean, let me just repeat the question. The question was about the status. Here we have a question of a slave woman and their children and the status. We find a parallel to this idea of slave women before. Avram had a wife, Hagar, Ishmael. They were slaves or servants or whatever they were of the Amoyas, of the Bila and Zilpah, were also not really truly wives, but also had a semi-slave status. What was the effect on the children? That's the question. There are two schools of thought. One is that we know, I mean, part of Jewish law, it's part of the Mishnah, it's a release from the time of Ezra, we see it enforced, but it's a part of the oral tradition that one's Jewishness is determined by the mother. If the child is a Jewish mother, child is Jewish. As the Mishnah says, if one has relations with a slave woman, the child is a slave. And it's a pasuk in the Torah. If a man, as in the Torah, if a Jewish man has relations with a slave woman, the woman and her children remains the chattel, the possession of the original owner. They are not free men, free people. It's clear in the Torah itself that it goes after the mother, not the father. But perhaps this was only created subsequent to the giving of the Torah. Before the Torah, just like amongst nations, if let's say the father is from Canaan and the mother is from Mitzrayim, from Egypt, the child is considered after the father. Just like by us, the father's a Kohen and the mother's a Levi, the child is a Kohen. Amongst the nations, status is created by paternity. Maternity is not a factor. So we know the Torah was given subsequent to the story of Abraham, of Avraham Avinu, the story of this is subsequent to Jacob. Perhaps the change of the difference how Jews deal with genealogy, with Yichus, and non-Jews, because again, non-Jews is after the father, Jews after the mother, maybe that transition only occurred after the Torah was given. Before the Torah was given, there was no such transition. That's one school of thought. The other school of thought has it that they were actually freed. And they actually became Jews, or whatever Jews meant before the actual giving of the Torah. But they actually did become Jews, and therefore the children are Jews. But there is this first opinion that transition from patrilineal to matrilineal descent took place at the giving of the Torah. And in the Torah itself, it's clear, at least in terms of a mother being a slave woman, the child is not Jewish. Yeah. Right. According to this first opinion, that Yishmael and Esav, our descendants, are truly Esav had Jewish women, we deal with they are the descendants of Abraham or Isaac, kind of thing. Right. The Jewish people only became fixed after Yaakov, after Jacob. We had those who were the descendants of, it seems early on, the king of Yehuda was exiled. As this goes back like in the 5th century before the Common Era. Says the king Yechonio was exiled. He had children. Zerubbabel was a descendant of his, and they created a family, and they knew they were of that family. Even though we ourselves may not have a complete documentation of our yichas, that family did, and they knew their genealogy. The question is, I don't know to this day. I know that there were descendants of that house, at least through Bustanoi, there were descendants of that house, I guess up to the 13th century. Beyond that, I don't know if there are descendants still that have records of them.
We hope you enjoyed this lecture. For more information about this lecture series and to order our audio cassettes and the accompanying outlines, please write to the Jewish Heritage Foundation, 15220 West Lincoln, Oak Park, Michigan, 48237.